Trump humiliated Netanyahu on camera, giving him the phone, making him call the Qatari prime minister and apologize.
Do you sometimes feel that, you know, maybe you should not be in Israel? That at some point, if this continues, there comes a moment where you're like, I will no longer participate in the violence that this state is creating.
There's no question in my mind that the Israeli government of Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and Smotrich will do everything that they can to provoke Palestinian violence in the West Bank, in Gaza. They would be very happy for this to break down and for them to go back to war. But Trump doesn't want that. But on the other hand, there are two things that were on the table, or at least in the Israeli political circles before the war, that are no longer there.
There's ethnic cleansing.
Annexation is off the table.
I mean, for now, there's no longer ethnic cleansing.
Hey, Trump said to Netanyahu, forget about annexation.
Trump won't be in power in 3 years' time.
I agree. He won't be in power forever. But if Netanyahu is reelected prime minister, then in my mind, Israel is beyond repair.
Gershon, I'm going to clap and then I'm going to look at the camera over there and do an intro, which will take about 25, 30 seconds, and then I'll start speaking to you.
Okay.
Hi, good day, and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. I'm your host, Ashfaq Karim, and today I'm very pleased to be joined by Gershon Baskin. Gershon, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Gershon has been one of the key people in putting together the deal, the Trump-led deal, to arrange a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. And we're here to dissect that plan, discuss and see if it's actually going to last. See very interestingly how that plan came about, a lot of initiative by Gershon himself and a few other actors, and discuss, I mean, I think not only is it going to last, but what comes afterwards. Can this potentially lead to a solution of sorts or not, and what the challenges are to that? But Gershon, you've been a go-between between Hamas and Israel, or other officials, sometimes it's quartet officials, etc., for almost 2 decades now, since about 2005, 2006, 18 years. Yes. So, I mean, and just after October 7th, I think you were very upset and very disappointed, and you kind of walked away from that role. And then Israel's actions kind of brought you back into the role. Take us through that process. I mean, not the whole 18 years. We know we don't have time for that. But I mean, just how the process of you walking back to the table and trying to get us to what eventually became this deal. Just walk us through all of that.
My primary interlocutor in Hamas over the years, not the only one, but the primary one, was Razi Hamad. I spoke to Razi Hamad on the second or third night of the war, when I heard on Israeli radio that his house had been bombed by Israel. And I called him on the phone to find out if he was alive. I didn't know. And he talked to me, and I noted Razi Hamad was the person who in Hamas is responsible for the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit being alive. There's no question about it. He was thought by most people to be the most, people called him the most moderate person in Hamas. I called him the most pragmatic person in Hamas. And when I heard that his house was bombed by Israel in the beginning of the war, I called him and I told him, Razi, if they're going after you, no one in Hamas is safe. Everyone is a target, everyone in Gaza is a target, in fact, after October 7th. I didn't know that he wasn't in Gaza, by the way. At the time, about a week later, a person who used to be the advisor to Yasser Arafat on Hamas, someone who I had a very good relationship with, sent me a WhatsApp. I hadn't heard from him for years. And he said, I ran into your friend the other day. And I said, you know, it's been a long time since we had contact. Who's my friend? He said, Razi Hamad. I said to him, are you in Gaza? And he said, no, I'm in Beirut. Razi's in Beirut. And I was really shocked by that. I didn't know. He was already acting as spokesperson for the war. I thought he was doing it from Gaza. And then Razi had this horrible interview on Lebanese television that everyone remembers.
Yes.
Where he said that Israel is a moral state that has no justification for existing. And October 7th was justified, and we do it again and again and again. And after he made that speech, I started writing a letter to him. The letter opened up more or less with, you're not the same Razi Hamad that I knew for many years. You're different. Something's changed. And I wrote to him that he was no longer worthy of talking to me. Now, that was the bottom line of the letter. And I decided to put the letter out in social media. It went viral. Really, millions of people saw it. It was in, the front page of the New York Times even. The following day or 2 days later, I was sitting in Sheikh Jarrah with my Palestinian partner and friend, Samer Sinjalawi. And Samer said to me, Gershon, you made a mistake. And I said, Samer, what mistake? He said, maybe your contact with Razi Hamad could save lives. And I thought about it. That was a very powerful statement. And I thought about it. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, I wrote to Razi and said, listen, if our contact can save human lives, then I'm willing to talk to you. He sent me back a message about 3 weeks later after that, and we renewed our contact. It's important to note that prior to cutting off relations, Razi and I were already discussing the first hostage deal. When I saw that of the 251 hostages that they had taken into Gaza, there were a large number of women, children, elderly people, I was convinced that this was not part of their planning. I know Hamas, I know what they're capable of, and I know what kind of things they would plan. And I was sure that they didn't plan to take children and women and elderly people. And I said to Razi, you know, can we make a deal to get these people home? And he was immediately open to that. I called a Palestinian friend who works for one of the Palestinian prisoners organizations, and I got details on the number of women prisoners and the number of minor prisoners. It was a small number. There was something like, I don't remember exactly, it was something like 59 women and 190 minors under the age of 18. I found out that none of them had killed Israelis. None of them were important Hamas people. None of them were from Gaza. They were all from the West Bank. The minute the National Emergency Government in Israel was created and Gantz and Eisenkot were brought in, I contacted them and told them Hamas is willing to make a deal for the women and children hostages in exchange for women and minors from Israeli prison, gave them the details, and they said immediately they would support it. That deal should have happened at the beginning of November. It was delayed because of the military pressure of Israel. When Israel announced that they surrounded the city of Gaza, I was sitting in the Egyptian embassy, and the Egyptians told me they expected to receive a list of names from Hamas that they were willing to release. And then while I was sitting in the meeting, they received a note that Hamas froze the process because of the Israeli surrounding of the city of Gaza. So all these people were screaming, only the military pressure will bring us home. I was sitting there and had firsthand evidence of how the military pressure delayed the deal that eventually happened in the end of November.
Okay. So, I mean, we've also heard clips of you, and you were saying that almost like for a year now, since last year, August, Hamas have been willing to put in the deal. Get us to the point. I mean, get us to the point where, you know, Trump comes into the White House or is about to get into the White House. The ceasefire goes into effect early in January, just, you know, a day before he actually takes office. And now there's this deal that's come about. And obviously, I've heard by seeing other interviews that you've had already on the subject that, you know, the strike on Qatar gave impetus to that. But also the reason why the strike on Qatar happened, well, against a house where Hamas was because they were discussing a deal. So just how do we then sort of move up to the point?
Prelude to that is the bad deal that Biden presented in May that he called the Biden-Netanyahu deal. And I immediately came out and criticized it because I didn't understand why they were making efforts to negotiate a deal for part of the hostages and for a short time ceasefire. It didn't make sense to me. If you're negotiating, let's end the war and let's bring home all the hostages. And I criticized it in the media. In August, I was contacted by hostage families who asked me to see if Hamas would be willing to make a better deal. I spoke to some Israeli military folks. I asked them, how long would it take Israel to withdraw from Gaza? They told me around 3 weeks. So I called it the 3-week deal, and Hamas, after going back and forth with a paper, got a paper from Hamas in Arabic and English with a voice message saying they agreed to this 3-week deal in which in a period of 3 weeks, they would return all the hostages in the first days and Israel would withdraw from Gaza within 3 weeks. It would be the end of the war. Palestinian prisoners would be released in the number and names agreed to. And they added to the whole picture that Hamas would no longer govern Gaza. They accepted the idea of a professional, non-Hamas technocratic government. I tried to get that to the Israeli negotiators. They rejected it because they said Netanyahu doesn't agree to end the war. I sent it to the Qataris and to the Egyptians. They told me they needed an American buy-in. I got it to the desk of President Biden, but his people wouldn't even look at it. They were singly focused on negotiating their bad deal. I went public. I was contacted by a retired Israeli general who was a former deputy head of the Mossad. He said, let me have a try. We negotiated a new kind of paper that included the same things so that he could say that he negotiated. He went back to the Israelis, to the army, to the Shin Bet, to the Mossad, to the government, and got no traction. And I told him to go public, and he went on Israeli television. He has a lot more credibility in the Israeli mainstream than I do. He's a retired general, former deputy head of the Mossad, and he got nowhere with it. I was invited to Qatar. The Qataris knew about the 3-week deal. But again, their bottom line message was, if the Americans don't push it, we can't do it. 3 weeks before Trump entered the White House, I had a meeting with the head of the Israeli Shin Bet, and I'm sitting in his office, and he asked me not to use my back channels with Hamas now because in 3 weeks there's going to be a ceasefire. I said, what do you mean 3 weeks? He said, in 3 weeks, Trump is entering the White House. Trump told Netanyahu that he wants a ceasefire before he enters the White House. There's going to be a ceasefire before Trump takes office. And as you said, on January 19th, this year, there was a ceasefire. But again, it didn't hold. The ceasefire agreement was that it was 60 days, releasing some of the hostages. On day 15, they were supposed to do talks about making the ceasefire permanent. By day 30, they were supposed to finalize the talks on a permanent ceasefire. The talks never happened. And Trump didn't force the end of the war then. I was really optimistic when Netanyahu made his first visit to Washington to meet with Trump. I really believed that Trump was going to tell Netanyahu, that's it, the war is over. I had already been communicating with Witkoff. My communication with Witkoff was mostly one directional, but I was getting acknowledgement. He was reading what I was sending him. He would sometimes comment with a word or two, I agreed with you, that's a good idea, send an emoji. It was mostly one-way communication. But when Netanyahu came back from Washington after his first visit, and he got the green light to finish off Gaza City and the central district, Deir al-Balah and Nusrat, it was clear to me that rather than Trump ordering Netanyahu, Netanyahu convinced Trump to give him a green light to continue with the military pressure. In my discussions with Witkoff, I understood what the problem was. They believe, the Americans believe, the Israeli narrative, that Hamas can be brought to surrender. Enough military pressure will defeat Hamas and they will raise a white flag. And I've been saying since at least 2008 that Hamas will never surrender to Israel, never. They will fight to the last Gazan, but they will not surrender to Israel. They will not raise a white flag. It's against their DNA, it's against their constitution. And you can't create deterrence against them because I already said in 2009, I think, on Israeli television, Hamas recruited their fighting force, the Nakba force, from bereaved families. They went from one family to another and recruited the youngsters in those families and told them, you need to get revenge. You need to fight for Palestine. You need to fight for Allah. You need to fight for Islam. And the highest duty that you have as a Muslim is to die as a martyr. And against that kind of theology, philosophy, belief system, you can have zero deterrence. What do? Threaten, I'm going to kill you? That's exactly the highest duty of their lives. So I think there's been a total misunderstanding of Hamas on the Israeli side, particularly from the military people. And Trump and Witkoff had no idea as well, if they thought that Hamas could be defeated. The breaking moment in that belief that Hamas would be brought to surrender, it was the attack by Israel on September 9th in Doha. Now, I was working with Witkoff already for a month before then on a deal because Witkoff believed that we could make a deal. Basically, it was a deal that Hamas was surrendering, but Witkoff was generous enough or a good enough negotiator that he knew that there had to be something in there that Hamas would get out of it that would be perceived as them as a victory of some kind or another. So we were actually working on a document, and Witkoff even got permission from Trump to meet with Hamas directly face to face, which is also unprecedented, never happened before. Razi Hamadan and I verified with other members of the Hamas leadership that Razi wasn't just speaking for himself, that there was agreement. He and I drafted an 8-point document that the leadership agreed to, and I wrote it in coordination with Witkoff. And around September 5th, September 6th, I remember the 8th, Hamas people met with the Qatari negotiating team, including the prime minister, and they were expecting to receive, because the Hamas didn't want to receive it from me. They had to receive it from the Qataris. It had to be official. So I understood from Witkoff that he gave the 8-point document to the Qataris, and they were meeting with Hamas team. And when they met with the team, the Qataris gave Hamas a document of 5 points. And it looked like the 5 points that Netanyahu had spoken about in the Israeli media, the Israeli demands for ending the war. And Hamas said to the Qataris, where's the 8-point document? And the Qataris had it and said, those are American ideas, but the 5 points is the American document. And I got contacted by them. They were very confused. They didn't know what happened. They thought, someone's playing a game here. I contacted Witkoff. I saw him on CNN. He was at the tennis tournament, sitting next to the president, typing away on his WhatsApp with me while he was sitting next to the president. I said, what's going on? The Qataris gave the Hamas 2 documents. They told them that the 8-point document is not official. It's American ideas. The 5-point document is. Witkoff told me to tell Hamas to agree to the 8 points and I'll bring the Israelis. So I told that to Hamas and they said, the Qataris keep telling us the 5 points is the big document. So there was a crisis. I told Witkoff, you got to straighten this out. There's got to be one document. The Qataris need to give it to Hamas. And it's got to be based on the 8 points that we agreed to. So on the evening of the 8th, he called me around 10:30 at night here, Jerusalem time, and told me that the Qataris are now sitting with Hamas, giving them the final version of the proposal. One document. It's based on the 8 points. And we expect an answer from Hamas quickly. Tell them to talk about the document and give us an answer. Witkoff proposed that immediately we arrange a meeting in Istanbul with the Hamas leadership that he would come to sign this paper. And then the 9th happened, which was the attack of Israel on the attempt to kill the Hamas leadership. Immediately after the attack, I contacted Witkoff and said, you realize that no one believes that Trump didn't give a green light for this. No one, probably no one in the world, definitely no one in the Middle East. And his immediate response was, we didn't do it, we didn't approve it, we were against it, we condemn it. You'll see Trump's going to put it out on his social media, on Truth Social. This is and the next days we're scrambling back and forth to assert, to dissociate Trump from the Israeli attack. On the 10th, I got a WhatsApp from one of the Hamas leaders, not Razi Hamid, someone else, who told me, because no one knew what happened, he told me we all survived. No one was killed from the leadership. We were instructed by the Qataris not to go outside and not to use our phones, so you're not going to hear from us. Over the next days, and they were pretty much in paralysis and shock. They didn't know what to do. I received a message, I think it was from Razi Hamid, who told me, we can't trust the Americans. The Americans are playing with us. They supported killing us. We can't trust them because there were two major issues that were sticking points for Hamas throughout the discussions. One was Israel renewing the war after they released the hostages. And the second one, that Israel will not redeploy entirely outside of Gaza. And the answer before the Doha attack was that President Trump was going to personally guarantee a side letter from the president, a presidential guarantee that both the war will not start and Israel will withdraw finally from all of, in stages, but they will withdraw from all of Gaza. Once there's a new government, a security force, a multinational force, there's security, Israel's not threatened, we will force Israel to withdraw. Hamas, I spoke to Hamas, the idea that the security perimeter around the Gaza-Israel border would be a no-entry zone, a shoot-to-kill zone between 500 meters and 1,000 meters wide, but there would be no Israeli soldiers there. Hamas agreed to that in principle. The Americans said, yeah, we can live with that. We can make the Israelis do that. But after Doha, the words of the president weren't enough. And it was crisis. About 10 days after Doha, Witkoff sent me a message, we have a plan, because I kept telling him, you got to end this now. The only way that the United States is going to save its reputation in the Arab world and stop this war, bring the hostages home, is to end it now, to have a plan to end it. I also told him that I think that had Israel, God forbid, succeeded in killing the Hamas leadership, the response would have been that all the hostages in Gaza would have been executed. I'm convinced of that. The Israelis said, we kill the Hamas leadership, we negotiate with the guys in Gaza, we'll bring them all home. But I think they were totally misconceived about what would happen if they had succeeded in killing them. I can't tell you with 100% certainty that the Americans didn't green light it. I don't know. They deny it and condemned it, et cetera, et cetera. At the end of the day, what happened was that Witkoff and Trump and Jared Kushner wrote the 21 points. They got all the Arab countries and Muslim countries and other European countries to agree to it. Netanyahu was ordered to come to the Oval Office after the General Assembly in the United Nations. Trump humiliated Netanyahu on camera, giving him the phone, making him call the Qatari Prime Minister and apologize. Trump scripted that entirely. He told Netanyahu what he had to say, and he made sure that Netanyahu said it. And when all the cameras left the room and there were no journalists in the Oval Office, Trump turned to Bibi Netanyahu and said, the war is over. You're going to get all your hostages home, but the war is over and you're going to declare that you accept it. And Trump creates reality by posting it in his Truth Social Israel agreed to the deal. Now Hamas has to agree to the deal. They sent it to Hamas and put out a deadline for Hamas by Sunday. They have to agree to the deal. And of course, Hamas responded with a lot of pressure from the Qataris and the Egyptians. Yes, but Trump ignored the but and published in social media that Hamas said yes. And then Trump called his friend Erdogan, who sent his intelligence chief, Ibrahim Kalin, to go to Qatar and tell the Hamas that they have to agree. And the Turks have a lot of leverage over Hamas, and they nailed Hamas to the deal, then called everyone to come to Sharm el-Sheikh. Again, unprecedentedly, the Americans, Witkoff and Jared Kushner, spoke directly to the Hamas guys. At the end, at 2 o'clock in the morning, when they initialed the agreement, the Hamas team was sitting in the same room with the Israelis and the Americans, the Qataris, the Egyptians, and the Turks. This has never happened before. And then we got to Sharm el-Sheikh, and the deal was done. And that was it, you know?
Sorry to interrupt you. It's fascinating. I mean, the details, the sort of the back channels and the efforts that were put into this. And you're right, in many ways, the assertion of Donald Trump and even him, I mean, especially I think the moment when he gets, Netanyahu to call the Qataris, it's something out of a movie, imagining Witkoff and the Hamas leadership after everything that's happened in the last years. Again, these are things that it sounds like a very dramatic movie. But I mean, I'm just going to now, the crux of the meat of what we're probably going to discuss today is, is this going to hold? I've seen that you are very optimistic about it. There's just, before I actually go back to you, I just want to not really challenge something you said, but just give another perspective on it. You mentioned that the Israelis don't understand Hamas's determination, their recruiting strategy, and that, they'd be willing to die to the last man. I mean, I'm a bit skeptical of that. I think there are some in the Mossad and the intelligence and even Netanyahu that may have an idea about that. But I think the other thing is, and you would agree to what's coming, is that Netanyahu obviously wanted to prolong this war as much as possible. That's one of the reasons why he did the strike on Qatar. I mean, we don't know if the Americans greenlit it, but definitely Netanyahu, it was his, he moved on this. That's one of the reasons. And I mean, as we've seen, and many people, who see our channel and have been hearing and seeing the images coming out of Gaza over the last 2 years, and just seeing the statements of the Israeli society, are very convinced that Israel wants to ethnically cleanse Gaza, right? So there is that background. So absolutely, there's this Trump intrusion, and he's definitely, he's publicly said he wants it to be part of his legacy. At the time when this was initiated, he was still seeking the Nobel Peace Prize. That's been given away now to someone else. So with that background, will this hold? I'm very skeptical. It's been refreshing to hear your optimism, but just tell me more optimism, or maybe now with a few more days gone, you're more skeptical as well. But just what's your thoughts on that?
Look, there's lots of reasons to be skeptical. But I think that, on the first night, the Israelis were already screaming that Hamas is violating, they're not returning the dead bodies, etc. I wrote to Witkoff immediately. I said, take this seriously. The people in the Israeli government, in the Ministry of Defense, in the army, are talking about going back to war. This is really serious. And he wrote back to me immediately, said, we're on it. And then he wrote back to me later, we're not going to let them go back to war. And I've been sending in documentation of accusations of breaches by both sides every day, several times a day, because he wants to know what the background is and who's saying what. And I told him very carefully, you need to, first of all, you created this international mechanism to verify that Hamas is working on the bodies, the Egyptians, the Qataris, and the Turks. The Egyptians sent people 2 days ago to Gaza. The Turks sent 200 people yesterday to Gaza. I wrote a piece just to clarify for everyone that they need to understand their objective realities on the ground. Even if Hamas wanted 100% to return all the bodies, they only control 50% of Gaza. That 50% of Gaza is decimated, is in ruins, in rubble. There are thousands of Gazans underneath the rubble of buildings that Israel bombed. There may have been Israelis there. There may be Israelis in tunnels that Israel destroyed. Hamas doesn't have any of the heavy equipment to remove the rubble and to search for those bodies. They don't have a forensic laboratory to identify bodies. If they sent a body of someone who was not an Israeli, it wasn't intentional, as the Israelis are claiming, because they don't have the ability to do DNA testing on every body that they find. So last night, the United States officially put out an announcement that, in their assessment, Hamas has not violated the agreement yet. And the mechanisms are built there. I also said with regard to the claims that Israel has already killed more than 15 Gazans since the peace, since the ceasefire deal was signed. And they used tank fire and drone fire on killing the Gazans. And I sent all the material that the accusations are Hamas to Witkoff. And I said, you guys need to verify this. And if the Israelis are doing it, you need to tell them to cease and desist. This cannot happen if you want to keep the ceasefire. These little breaches became major breaches. This is our history. I mean, Israel and the PLO signed six agreements and then went forward and breached every single one of them. This is normal for Israelis and Palestinians. And the Americans have to be on it. There are a lot of things that have to happen now, immediately, urgently, in order to make sure that this is not derailed. There needs to be a new Palestinian government in Gaza. It needs to be announced. There's no mechanism for that, how that's going to happen. Now, while Mahmoud Abbas has almost zero legitimacy on the streets of Palestine, he remains the international legitimate address for Palestine. And it was quite surprising, I must say, to see him show up in Sharm el-Sheikh, the person who a month before Trump wouldn't let in the United States to speak at the United Nations General Assembly, showed up in Sharm el-Sheikh. When I approached the Egyptians and said, how are you going to talk about the future of Gaza without Gazans being there? Their response to me was, how can we invite Gazans when we can't invite Mahmoud Abbas, the president of Palestine? And then Mahmoud Abbas was there. I wrote to Abbas today saying that I hope he's going to be the person announcing the new government that'll be made up of Gazans. It won't be the Palestinian Authority, but it needs to have the legitimacy even for the bottom line of asserting that Palestine will no longer be divided. None of the Arab neighbors and the Palestinians themselves don't want two Palestinian governments. They want Palestine to be united. Of course, the only way to unite Palestine is by having elections. And Abbas agreed to that, to Mohammed bin Salman and to Emmanuel Macron, and then at the New York summit, to the Franco-Saudi summit. So we don't know if the 12 months that he talked about is going to be from June when he wrote the letter or from now the ceasefire. It doesn't matter. It's a matter of a couple of months. Palestinians have to have elections. There will be a new non-Hamas government in Gaza soon. It'll be made up of Gazans for Gaza. The government of Gaza will be Gazans. There will be a Palestinian security force in Gaza made up of people who have been trained in Egypt over the last months, supplemented by others. Some of the young Hamas guys who joined Hamas over the last year, it might be incorporated into it. These are not ideological Hamas people. They're 16, 17, 18-year-old kids who were given a gun, a uniform, and $200 or $300. And they can be incorporated into a security force as well, subordinate to the new government. There will be, next week, they're supposed to be, a meeting of the Security Council in New York, where Witkoff will be presenting an American draft resolution to package this whole agreement into international legitimacy and legality and provide a mandate for the stabilization force, this multinational force that will be sent to Gaza that countries have already agreed to participate in, Arab countries, European countries, and other countries. And that's the main guarantee that Hamas is getting, that Israel won't attack again. There'll be a buffer there, an international force, which will prevent Hamas from attacking Israel and Israel from attacking Gaza. And there are commitments already before this agreement was signed for more than $2 billion to begin the reconstruction work of Gaza, which is clearing away rubble, making space for temporary housing, caravans, tents, water, electricity, all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure that at the Sharm el-Sheikh summit, Trump got commitments for many, many more billions of dollars that will go in. This peace board that Trump talks about that no one really understands what it's going to do, Witkoff described it to me as a kind of a receivership of a bankrupt company. It will deal with the finances. It will manage the money coming in. It will make sure it's going for the right construction projects. I'm sure that the Americans will seek their own benefits and Tony Blair will seek his own benefits, but it'll be to the best of ability in the international community and humanitarian aid system, probably the best possible, least bureaucratic kind of mechanism for seeing that money is put on the ground in Gaza for reconstruction. And what else did I want to say? That's the big picture of what's supposed to happen.
Okay, so Gershon, I mean, it seems like a very ambitious roadmap and a very, very effective roadmap. But I just want to, again, throw some skepticism on what's occurring right now on Gaza. So for the last the last 24 hours or so, or 48 hours, there's been gangs, Israeli armed gangs that have been operating in Gaza.
Palestinian gangs armed by Israel.
Yes, not exactly. Israeli, right? Yeah, sorry. So, thanks for clarifying that. Right. So, Palestinian gangs in Gaza armed by Israel. Just this morning, there's reports in the Israeli media that Hamas actually intercepted a shipment of about 40 trucks, pickup trucks. That is not big trucks, of Kalashnikovs and weapons that were meant to go to gangs. So clearly, Israel, with Netanyahu leading it, is trying to stoke fires. That's going to agitate Hamas quite a lot. They need to disarm, but at the same time are collecting new weapons, which I'm sure if they want to go ahead with the elaborate plan that you just mentioned, they will kind of try to abide by. But obviously the people in Hamas, the senior people in Hamas in Gaza, are definitely feeling, you can just see, they're probably feeling very apprehensive about disarming.
So on the other hand, it's important to note that the Hamas leadership did agree, not in
100%.
Writing, but they did agree that Hamas people in Gaza, commanders who want to leave Gaza can leave Gaza with their families, and the Americans are giving them amnesty, whatever that means. And Hamas leadership outside, who said in public that they don't agree to that, did agree to it, and the Hamas commanders in Gaza know that.
Okay, right. So, the big question is, and I'm sort of was building that context, and I'm sure the plans that are in place that you and Witkoff and the Qataris and the Hamas leadership have put in place. But it sounds like, and this is again unprecedented, that Israel weren't part of that, and usually that's what they always are. It's the Israelis driving a deal. It's the Americans signing off on it. Obviously, I've read the wording of the 21 points, and some of those points, especially when you get from like 10 onwards, or the things that come much later. It's like kind of, and maybe this is Trump playing one on Netanyahu, but a lot of those points are usually like the Oslo kind of points, the peace process points. Israel will decide if it feels secure. Israel will decide and then it unilaterally has the power to do whatever it likes, right? So why would this be different?
Yeah, I'm not looking that far in the future, because in my opinion, as long as Netanyahu is in power in Israel, there's no chance of Israeli-Palestinian peace. We know that there's not going
to
be any...
At this point, it's not even peace, but it's why would he want to allow that ceasefire to advance to a point where be more stability
in Gaza? He wouldn't, and Netanyahu wanted to continue the war, and there's no question in my mind that the Israeli government of Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and Smotrich will do everything that they can to provoke Palestinian violence in the West Bank and Gaza. They would be very happy for this to break down and for them to go back to war. But Trump doesn't want that, at least for now. Trump is committed to this deal, is committed to the war ending. I think when he talked in his lofty terms about eternal peace, and Trump takes himself seriously.
I know lots of the world don't, but I think his fan base does, and I think he takes himself more seriously than anyone else does.
Well, for sure. And I have no doubt that in Trump's mind, and Witkoff said it, and Witkoff believes it for himself also, this is the most important thing he's ever done. And he's not going to wander away and get involved in something else and forget this. And Jared Kushner, and I spoke to Jared Kushner on Saturday night. It was my first time ever talking to him. I was really surprised. He told me that Witkoff shared every message that I sent to Witkoff, all our conversations, and he thanked me. And I was very surprised, because he was very supportive of the kind of things that I was saying. But forget about me. I'm not a factor here. I think that... there is a commitment that this war will not be renewed. That's very difficult to prevent the war from, not continuing, which is what the Israelis want. But I think that Hamas doesn't have a choice. I really think, and people ask me to prove it, but I'm saying that 90% of the people, at least in Gaza, don't want to see another Hamas person in the rest of their lives. They blame Israel and hold Hamas responsible.
That's your analysis, right? That's how the way you always, there's not like polling data or anything.
No, there isn't polling data, but everyone I talk to in Gaza, and I talk to a lot of people, Hamas people told me our people in Gaza need to hold onto their guns to protect themselves from the Gazans. That's what Hamas people in leadership told me.
Hold on to their guns to protect themselves from these gangs that Israel are...
Gangs, from the Gazan citizens. From the Gazan citizens, not from the gangs. We weren't talking about the gangs.
Yeah, yeah.
The gangs is something, you go to any conflict zone where you have an occupation, you'll find that the occupation power finds
always,
drug
always,
lords
yeah, and, always. It's a usual tactic, yes.
Criminals to to fight the war for them. That's what Israel did. It's not surprising. And Hamas is brutal. They're executing people. We saw it on film, them executing people. And I wrote to Hamas people, I said, that's disgraceful. When we get to the point where Palestinians are killing Palestinians in Gaza after everything has been through, you should be ashamed of yourselves.
One can see how that would have been inevitable, though, right? After Israel were arming people, funding them.
Nonetheless, I feel a moral responsibility to say to Hamas that this is disgraceful, and you should not be supporting it.
Okay, so it sounds like from everything you said, the next 2 to 3 weeks is really critical in terms of what occurs, in terms of setting up some sort of transitory government administration to kind of get the ball rolling and to ensure that in the short term the war isn't kind of renewed, right?
So it's really important, the multinational force, the Security Council resolution is really essential, because the governments of the world won't send troops without this framework of international legitimacy and legality. And the money flowing is really important. And what's also very important is that the Americans uphold that the Israeli withdrawal will continue, that they're not going to stay at the yellow line and occupy 50% of Gaza. The Israeli withdrawal has to continue.
And the other than Trump saying Netanyahu, this needs to happen, which I'm sure he will go that far, but Netanyahu will create and manufacture excuses and a reality. My concern is, assuming we get all of these things that occur in the next 2 to 3 weeks, which honestly would be, I do think that Trump may have the staying power for those 2-3 weeks. But I mean, after that, it's very easy to get distracted. It's very easy for the Israelis to create a reason, or for an actual viable reason for them to occur, right? For them to say, we need to go back in, or we're not going to move the yellow lines. We're not even going to move the yellow lines slightly. We're not going to move to what they said, you know, a perimeter of 500 meters to a kilometer. I mean, there's just so many conundrums, right? And then there's beyond that, there's Netanyahu. I mean, he's in power for a while. Of course, he will. I mean, Trump has said that he asked the Knesset to pardon him on the corruption trial thing.
He asked the president. He was asked on Air Force One on the way back to Washington if the Israelis asked him to do that. He said, yeah, they asked him. I wasn't going to do it, but then the right moment came and I did. And my response I put on social media was that innocent people don't need a pardon. Well, this is...
Okay. I don't think Netanyahu should be pardoned. One of the silver linings to him being pardoned is that that will make him less motivated to continue war so he can stay in power. Right?
Particularly because the only condition on which pardon would be acceptable to the Israeli public is if he steps out of public life forever. He wouldn't be pardoned in any way. Listen, all the things that you mentioned and all the reasons for skepticism are true. But we don't need a crystal ball here. We're talking about things that are supposed to happen soon.
Yes, 100%.
And we will know. 100%. We will know if they're going to happen or not, and then we'll be able to discuss it and see what alternatives there are. There are always choices to be made. It's never one directional. There are always multi directions that it could go. The most important thing in my mind is that the mediators, the Qataris, the Turks, the Egyptians, and the Americans stay focused and keep the pressure on both sides to implement their commitments right now and to move this forward. This is where it's going to lie, because we have to assume that both sides want to screw it up, or both sides will screw it up. And right now it's really going to be dependent on Trump, Witkoff and Kushner, Tony Blair a little bit, and the Egyptians, the Qataris and the Turks, who definitely don't want this war to renew.
Okay, so again, you said both sides want to kind of screw it up. The truth of the matter is, one side really has the power, though, to screw it up.
Oh, of course. No, both sides have the power. The Hamas attacks an Israeli battalion. This starts it. Both sides, with a strike of a match, can light the fire.
Okay. I mean, Israel could even say that they've been attacked, and then something.
Of course, and they've done that in the past.
Okay. So almost shocking to me. I mean, it's no longer become shocking because it's been 2 years, and so it gradually has become shocking. But if I just went to sleep on the 6th of October and now woke up, what's become very shocking, I think, to most people in the world, besides, you know, the horrible images they've seen of Gaza and October 7th attack itself, but is just how Israeli society seems to be very, very unhinged, right? And I can hear the sort of the drive in your voice as someone who was involved in this deal, as someone who belongs to a very tiny minority in Israel that's been working towards what you've been working for decades, quite frankly, right? But it seems like the Israeli society has just become more right. There was a Hebrew University poll done about 3 months ago where 64% of the population, believe that there are no innocents in Gaza. The Haaretz poll, it's often cited, it's I think now about 4 or 5 months old, where 48% of Israeli society want to see both the Gaza and the West Bank ethnically cleansed. So with that in mind, even if this very tentative ceasefire can come into place, and even that ceasefire doesn't at all, and you agree with this, guarantee that the lives of people in Gaza get slightly better. It gets better because obviously they're not being bombed anymore, which is a massive deal. But I mean, substantially, in the fact that, you know, they have enough toilets, they have a roof over their heads, they have, you know, some blankets to keep warm, water, basic food, never mind, I mean, everything else that comes out of society, you know, justice system, schooling, all of those kind of things. So where does this leave? Where has this war now, which hopefully is winding down, right, if not ended entirely, where does it leave the chance of Palestinian liberation or having a state for themselves, even if it's now a very, very puny state compared to the 1967 borders? Where does it leave that?
My first comment would be that wartime polls are not relevant. And everyone quotes those polls and how much to the right the Israeli society has moved. And if you take a snapshot of the moment, that's 100% true. No question about it. I'm even concerned because I think Israeli society has become more religious. And in my mind, that's not where Israel needs to be, in my own personal sense of Israel as a modern liberal democracy, or what Israel needs to be, a modern liberal democracy. And we've moved further away from that. And Palestinian side is also moved further away from the belief that peace is possible and a two-state solution is achievable. And both societies are affected deeply by the reality of the 2 years of war, of the war crimes committed by Israel since October 7th, genocide, of the suffering of Palestinians, 1,000 people killed in the West Bank in the 2 years, 26 new settlements, 100 new outposts, thousands of olive trees cut down. People are starving. They don't have money. 200,000 Palestinians who worked in Israel before the war and have been unemployed since. The situation is really, really bad on both sides. And both sides are societies in trauma, both. For Palestinians that I speak to, the last 2 years is worse than the memory of the Nakba. Worse than the memory of the Nakba. And I think it goes for Palestinians all over the world, not just for Palestinians all in Palestine. And for Israeli Jews, this is literally the most dramatic event that's happened to Jews since the Holocaust. It's affected the whole Jewish people and particularly the Israeli people. But I really believe that once we begin to get out of the trauma on both sides, there's going to be an awakening, a kind of epiphany of a realization that we can't keep doing this. We've been killing each other for 100 years. And we can't do it. This has to be the last war. I think we have a lot of help in the international community now, because for one, I don't think the international community is willing to give Israel impunity anymore. Israel has begun to be isolated. There are consequences for the illegal actions of the state of Israel. The recognition of the state of Palestine doesn't change the life of Palestinians. That will only happen when Israel recognizes the state of Palestine. But this impacts Israeli society and the fact that Israelis are not welcome in the world anymore, and Israelis like to travel, they like to be here in the world. All these things that Israel has done have consequences, and there are consequences for the Palestinians as well. I take a lot of note of Rashid Khalidi's last book, of the 100-year war on Palestine, or 100-year war against Zionism. I remember what it's called.
100-year war on Palestine.
So 90% of Rashid's book, which I think was excellent, is really saying his message is, we as Palestinians will never grant legitimacy to Zionism. That's 90% of the book. The last chapter of the book says the following, and I'm paraphrasing, of course. He's saying, while we will never recognize the legitimacy of Zionism, we as Palestinians have to deal with the reality of Israel. Israel's there, not going away. My conclusion, from the beginning of the war, I wrote this in the first week of the war, at the end of this war, there's still going to be 7 million Israeli Jews and 7 million Palestinians living between the river and the sea. And the only solution that enables us to resolve the conflict is to answer what we're killing each other about. And that's a territorial expression of identity. I feel a great solidarity with people who talk about a one-state solution of democracy and equality and all, but that doesn't answer what we've been killing each other for 100 years. Israelis want a Jewish state, which they call their own. Palestinians want a Palestinian state, which they call their own. People have been fighting for a territorial expression of identity. The two-state solution, which I thought was dead, is back on the table. It's going to be back on the table even more. And I believe that once we get rid of Netanyahu, and probably once we get rid of Mahmoud Abbas, and we have a new generation of leadership, there's going to be this awakening of realization that we have to settle this conflict. There is no viable armed struggle. Palestinians are not going to free Palestine by killing Israelis. Israelis have no military solution to the conflict. This conflict cannot be managed. It has to be resolved, and the only way is through a peaceful resolution of two states living with open borders and peace, not walls and fences, and not cantons, and not settlers stealing Palestinian land, but a real two-state solution. It doesn't do justice to anyone, in particular the Palestinians. They're going to get 22% of the land of Palestine. There will be an adjustment of borders. A 4.4 annexation and exchange of territories of equal size will incorporate 82% of the settlers under Israeli sovereignty. That deals with a big part of the problem, not at all. There are lots of problems, Jerusalem, and there are solutions for everything. The moment that the Israelis and the Palestinians recognize that there are two nations living on this land that both have a legitimate claim to say that they belong here, then we will find the solutions for all of it. And this is possible. I know this sounds like La La Land or Dream World.
It does sound like La La Land, and it doesn't sound like La La Land because it's an unrealistic, pragmatic dissolution of it. In fact, it is a pragmatic solution to it. But it sounds like La La Land because of the actions that we've been seeing, and the fact that you say that a generation of leadership will come. Mahmoud Abbas is very old; he's 89. Netanyahu will be out of power, but I don't see the Israeli society soon electing someone who is going to be keen on the dream that you have just put forth. To a large extent, the Palestinians will have to get what they accept now, right? Because especially after what we've seen in the last 2 years, they've been bludgeoned into submission in many ways, without knowing the details that you've gone into. And I saw that 21-point plan and all the journalists that I speak to in this newsroom and others, it looked like a submission document. It looked like there's nothing left to fight for. This is what you're going to do right now, because, in many ways, anyone who's seen the destruction in Gaza would it's been a horrid, devastating genocide, and this is exactly what Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and Gallant and Netanyahu said. They're going to destroy everything in Gaza, turn it into rubble.
But on the other hand, there are two things that were on the table, or at least in the Israeli political circles before the war, that are no longer there. There's no more cleansing. Annexation is off the table.
For now, there's no longer ethnic cleansing. Okay.
Trump said to Netanyahu, forget about annexation.
Trump won't be in power in 3 years' time.
I agree. He won't be in power forever, but Trump is the opportunity now to make the difference, and we have to push for it to be made now. I agree with you. Anything could change. And the other thing that's off the table is ethnic cleansing. The ethnic cleansing that the Israelis hope to do in the West Bank and in Gaza is off the table. It's not going to happen now. Anything could happen in the future.
It's off the table for now. I think it's off with the current trajectory that Trump is trying to take things through. It's off the table for. I agree with you on that. Gershon, just a few more questions. We have about 10 more minutes, and I know that you're a busy person and you're making many media appearances, and you may have to WhatsApp Steve Woodkoff anytime. So I won't keep you.
I actually have to go to an event that the German Consul General is holding in Jerusalem.
Okay,
this.
So just a few things, right? Obviously, you moved to Israel, I think it was about 40 years ago?
Almost 48 years ago.
48 years ago, and for the vast majority of that time, you've been involved in trying to find a solution. You run a sort of a think tank, committee, activist circle, I don't know how you actually want to frame it, you could probably better, that does this. This is a bit of an uncomfortable question, right? But you've seen firsthand over 40 years how obviously, there's been acts of resistance and often immoral resistance from the Palestinians, right? But it resistance nonetheless. But you've seen, for 40 years how Israel, or longer than that, how Israel has strangled the peace process. They've trodden on the rights of Palestinians, killed them in large amounts. Do you sometimes feel that, maybe you should not be in Israel? At some point, if this continues, there comes a moment where you're like, I will no longer participate in the violence that this state is creating.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's a really difficult question. My daughter, who was my firstborn, it left Israel 7.5 years ago with her husband and her baby because they decided they didn't want to raise their children in Israel because of Israeli society and the militarism of the society and the ongoing conflict and the occupation. And my daughter's husband is a native-born Israeli whose father is one of the top journalists in Israel and was once the spokesperson of the Israeli army under Yitzhak Rabin when he was Minister of Defense. So this is a really rooted Israeli family. And my daughter left, lives in the south of France. I'm actually going at the end of the month to visit her. My two sons, one is 31 years old and the other is 33 years old, who both managed to go through the army without being combat soldiers, never went to the occupied territories, but managed to do a military service without having to be part of the occupation directly, and have asked me since day one of the war for me to put red lines when Israel is no longer a place that I can live. And it was a big struggle. We have dinner every Sabbath Eve, every Friday night. And for months at the beginning of the war, they said, "How can you see that we have a future in this country?" And I put two red lines down on the table. One was really easy. That was, I said, if Ben-Gvir ever becomes prime minister, I could no longer live in this country. The second red line that I put on the table presents me with a real problem, because the second red line is, after everything we've been through, if Netanyahu is reelected prime minister, then in my mind, Israel is beyond repair. And that's a scenario that could happen. And then I have a real dilemma because, honestly, although I was born in America and I lived for 21 years in America, I don't feel at home in America. I have an American passport. Israel is my home. I don't define myself as a Zionist anymore. Years for years, I thought that what's done in the name of Zionism is everything I'm against. I can't call myself a Zionist. But I've spent my whole entire adult life in this country, and I'm an Israeli. That's my identity. Israel is home. Jerusalem is my home. And one of the things that makes it my home, particularly Jerusalem, is the fact that it's both Israeli and Palestinian. That's part of my identity, of who I am, of how I live. I live on both sides of this conflict, deeply in contact with people at, the level of being welcome in people's homes on both sides of this conflict. So it's a real dilemma. And there could come a point where I will find myself homeless, where I will not be able to live in this country anymore.
Okay, thank you. Final question. I mean, that's actually a good note to leave the interview on, but I just have one more question for you. How has Israel changed from Israel you came to, that you arrived in the 70s, 80s, just judging on the 48 years you've been there? How has that society changed from the one that you are living in now?
Look, part of the change might be the change of me moving from naivete to being more based in reality, because I used to perceive Israel as a society that actually wanted to live in peace with its neighbors. And Israel is not a society today which is interested in living in peace with its neighbors. They say they are, but everything they do says that they're not. I believe that at a point when I came in the late 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, through the beginning of the peace process, there was at least a self-affirmation in the society that we actually do want to live in peace with our neighbors. I know we could look at the history of Israel and identify everything that Israel does or did that proves that Israel never wanted to live in peace with their neighbors, but I think it was part of a self-image, at least. We told ourselves that we wanted to live in peace with our neighbors, and that's changed. Israelis have no problem saying how much they hate the Arabs and wish the Arabs were never here, and what did Netanyahu call us, a villa in the jungle? We're not a villa in the jungle. We're the villa in one of the most important regions of the world that's becoming very attractive to a big part of the population of this planet. And the Middle East is changing, and Israel is moving in the opposite direction. Israel has become more religious, more racist, more hateful, more difficult to live in, more intolerable. The behavior of Israelis on the streets driving is an indication of the underlying trauma and anger that Israelis feel toward each other. We've had a divisive prime minister, the longest serving prime minister in Israel, who has built his career on creating divisions and hatred within our society, not hatred against Arabs, Jews hating Jews. And that's very different. You know, I knew Rabin, and I think that one of the things that made Rabin a hero was the change that he made of being Mr. Military, Mr. Security, into the realization that Israel had to make peace. And I don't know that Rabin made it 100% along the road, because he was killed and he never got to finish the job. But that was the image of the good Israeli, the person who looked at our past and decided we need a different future. And we don't have that today.
Gershon Bascon, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Unapologetic is a show that unapologetically looks at the life, times, and views of some unapologetic and not-so-unapologetic humans, hosted by me, Ashfar Karim. We hope this week's episode enabled you to learn something. Subscribe to stay connected with us. Your support means we can continue bringing you more of these stories. Until next time, goodbye.